Welcome to Shift with CJ. I'm your host CJ, and together we will explore the areas of health, human performance, biohacking, psychology, and much more that will inspire you to become the best version of yourself.
Very famous paper in the longevity world called Hallmarks of Aging. One of the lines in the introduction says that aging is basically a one side of the coin, and the other side of the coin is cancer.
One of the leading voices in preventative healthcare.
Pioneering AI-driven solutions to combat age-related diseases and transform the future of medicine.
Adam Bataille.
That got me thinking about, is cancer just a disease of aging? That got me thinking about what other diseases of aging are there? And why don't we think about aging as the primary cause of disease?
Aging is not inevitable, and there are ways to kind of like extend your lifespan or even reverse aging. Now I think there are 12 hallmarks of aging because gut metabolism and gut health wasn't a part of the original paper, and now they've put it on. There are also some other communication pathways that have been added.
In the hallmarks of aging paper, they try to do the same with aging cells. What observations can we see in aging cells that differ from a young normal cell? I always try to dissociate between like things like lifestyle and then explaining these things with a kind of a mechanistic in a genetic way.
If you had a time machine and if you could go back in time, this is my last question. If you could go back in time and you could give your younger self one piece of advice, what would that be? Adam, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. You have an amazing story, which I want you to share with our guests. You know, medicine, oncology, genomics, startups. Where did all this begin?
Well, I mean, I started as a medical student, but I've always been interested in kind of off the beaten track kind of paths. Mm-hmm. But as a medical student, I think what got me interested in longevity early on was I saw this paper. It's a very famous paper in the longevity world called The Hallmarks of Aging, published in 2013. One of the lines in the introduction says that aging is basically one side of the coin, and the other side of the coin is cancer. So basically cancer and oncology and longevity are two sides of the same coin. That got me thinking about kind of, is cancer just a disease of aging? Like, we don't usually think of it like that. We don't even learn of cancer as being a disease of aging when we learn about cancer. I ultimately, you know, went on to study cancer I have a postgrad certification in cancer, and I specialized in cancer. But that got me thinking about what other diseases of aging are there, and why don't we think about aging as the primary cause of disease? And that, I think that view is starting to change. But if you look at primary diseases of aging, like cancer, heart disease, kidney dysfunction, lung problems, heart disease, metabolic dysfunction, age is the number one factor when it comes to development of these diseases. So that got me interested in longevity. I ultimately went on to leave medicine for a bit and focus on health tech. So we started a company in the bio-wearable space called Span Health that was a coaching platform, a longevity coaching platform that used your bio-wearable data. We would interpret that data for you. This was a bit early on, before bio-wearables were that common. And then we would give you recommendations based on that. We eventually got acquired, and then I went back to medicine, and then started a new venture, which is an online longevity clinic based out of the UK.
Wow, exciting journey. You mentioned that paper. A lot of people, especially in the biohacking world, became more curious after that paper came in, because somewhere, if I can remember it right, in that paper, it was mentioned that aging is not inevitable, and there are ways to kind of like extend your lifespan or even reverse aging. And they talk about these 9 hallmarks of aging. But I think recently they have updated this even more. Now I think there are 12 hallmarks of aging, because gut metabolism and gut health wasn't a part of the original paper, and now they've put it on. There are also some other communication pathways that have been added, correct?
Yeah, I mean, look, the way to think about the hallmarks of aging paper is in the context of, it actually is there's an earlier paper called The Hallmarks of Cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hallmarks of Cancer paper was a seminal paper in oncology that explained the different kind of observations that we see that differentiate a cancer cell from a normal cell, right? So in the Hallmarks of Aging paper, they try to do the same with aging cells. So what observations can we see in aging cells that differ from a young normal cell?
Mm-hmm.
And then that obviously got updated, and some people kind of took it in other ways. So there's a big debate about like certain mm-hmm. hallmarks of aging. Is it considered a hallmark or not? But ultimately, these are just observations that we see.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, the ultimate cause of aging is probably, upstream of all of these kind of hallmarks that we see.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different theories about this. I mean, one of the most interesting theories for me is a theory called hyperfunction mm-hmm. theory of aging, which looks at genetic drivers of aging in the context of something called antagonistic pleiotropy. So what that is it's a very interesting concept. When we're growing up, when we're younger, you're basically programmed to develop into an adult, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so your genetics are kind of pushing you in that direction. But after you become an adult, your genetics, the same pathways continue to be activated, but without an end goal of developing into something else. So it becomes hyper-function, which ultimately leads to development of hyper-functional disorders, like the hyper-function of cells, of cancer cells, for example, mm-hmm. hyper-function leading to heart disease, metabolic dysfunction. All these diseases of aging can be looked at with that lens. And we actually see that, I mean, one of the major pathways of aging is a very known pathway called mTOR, mm-hmm. which is a kind of genetic pathway that leads to growth. And mm-hmm. inhibition of mTOR is a kind of a pro-longevity intervention in mice. In humans, it's still debated.
Mm-hmm. Lots of biohackers using rapamycin for that.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about that in a bit. I mean, it's a very interesting drug. I've written some articles about it. But the idea is that growth in the beginning, in the first part of your life before you're an adult, is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
It leads to adulthood. But then that unfettered growth after adulthood, it might be a cause of aging. I think it's a... Mm-hmm. fascinating kind of theory.
It's interesting because also when we're programmed, so the way I look at it is like with evolution, all of the things that were like humans had to do were really hard. So you had to, you know, hike 6, maybe 4 hours, 5 hours. You had to walk, you had to hunt, you had to do all these things. And all of those things required excess amounts of energy. Still, excess amount of food wasn't available. And now excess amount of food is available, but we aren't using any of that. So this again, just a calorie surplus by itself, which most people have in these days where we can tap an app and get the pizza or burger or even like salad. Sometimes people overdose on like salads.
Mm.
That causes a caloric surplus, which can then cause an mTOR spike. And because people aren't doing the lifestyle things, we're so mismatched from what we have evolved to be like. And now, you know, 9 hours on in a desk sitting, hunching your back, looking on Instagram or like typing, looking at just one single source of like screen is so common.
Yeah, well, I mean, while I, you know, agree with the general, you know, your general take, I always try to kind of dissociate between kind of what we... like things like lifestyle
mm-hmm.
and then explaining these things with a kind of a mechanistic genetic in a genetic way. The reason for that is these things are, biology is super complex. And when you look at cellular biology, it doesn't come down to one pathway like mTOR or whatever. There's loads of pathways within cells that lead to growth, and inhibiting one pathway leads to overactivation of a different pathway. And it's, and then if you have multiple cells organ level, you have different phenomena, and then on an organism level, you have different phenomena. So it really is difficult to kind of translate things like, you know, overeating to simply as, you know, overactivating mTOR, which leads to aging. There's loads of kind of complexity in between. But, you know, I definitely agree that abundance of energy leads to shifting our body environment into that harmful place of hyperfunction, instead of being in a kind of restricted energy state where where it's less pro-inflammatory and healthier on the long term. I mean, there are studies to show that calorie restriction, for example, is a very powerful intervention to lower all types of metabolic dysfunction markers, like insulin resistance, cholesterol markers. And on the long term, it seems to extend life as well in other organisms like mice.
And fruit flies.
Yeah.
So there is this concept, right? Because a few years ago, when this concept of mTOR was rising in popularity, there were two schools of thought, and maybe now there are three. So I just want to share this with you, and I want to get your take on it. So one school of thought says calorie restriction is good, and mTOR restriction is good. And then, you know, you have things like metformin, rapamycin, all of these things that inhibit mTOR. And but there is a downside to it, because inhibiting mTOR too much means that you can become frail over a long period of time, which is your mitochondrial health. And correct me if I'm wrong, your mitochondrial energy production will be compromised. Your, you know, the effects that you might have from going to the gym, endurance, strength training, any kind of training will also be compromised. And then that could eventually you becoming, or are you aging a little bit faster? And then there's another concept of, like, you know, muscle-centric medicine, where people are talking about, okay, you know what? Even if you increase mTOR, if you're increasing mTOR to gain more skeletal muscle mass, which will then become a glucose disposal agent because muscle is a glucose disposing agent, it's going to be better off in the long run. So I met two different kinds of people, one who've got really skinny, saying that, oh, mTOR is really bad, and like they lost a lot of muscle. And then one group of people who were like, you know what, for lack of a better word, fuck it. I'm just going to make sure that at least I'm doing it the right way. Because even when you, correct me if I'm wrong, like when you look at two groups of macronutrients, like protein, amino acids, and carbohydrates actually raise mTOR much more than amino acids, specific, apart from like leucine specifically. So, like, what's your take on, like, is having mTOR and muscle good, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good theoretical question to ask, but I mean, we can kind of just look at the data, right? So it doesn't seem that lowering muscle mass has a positive impact on longevity, especially in later years. And having a healthy muscle mass, a higher muscle mass, is a pro longevity biomarker. When you look at animal studies, you do see kind of signs of frailty and lower kind of energy in mice that are mTOR inhibited, and that might be kind of a long-term, their quality of life might be low, and while extending their lifespan, that might be an issue. But in humans, I think humans are just a bit more complex than mice. And what we see in mice doesn't always translate to humans. So a good example here is prolonged fasting. Mm-hmm. Prolonged fasting in mice is an intervention that increases lifespan. And it improves all sorts of biomarkers. Whereas in humans, prolonged fasting can sometimes have a negative impact on things like insulin sensitivity, paradoxically. And that is probably related to impact on muscle. And possibly because you're fasting for a prolonged period of time. Like, there's a study on people who fasted 5 days, mm-hmm. and then their insulin sensitivity actually got a bit worse. Mm-hmm. There might be some kind of adaption there, because mm-hmm. you're not getting any glucose in for five days, and then mm-hmm. when you reintroduce it into your diet, then your metabolism is actually worse. So it just gives us, like, the idea is that humans are way more complex than mice, mm-hmm. and not everything that works in mice can translate to humans. And that's why we need human randomized controlled trials mm-hmm. in humans to kind of test these things. But that doesn't mean that we can't do anything outside of randomized controlled trials. Mm-hmm. I believe that we can do things on an individualized basis, mm-hmm. which, you know, some people call biohacking. I think under the right conditions and under mm-hmm. And doing things safely, I think there is a place mm-hmm. for self-experimentation in a safe way. Mm-hmm. So, for example, rapamycin. I do think that rapamycin has potential to be a longevity drug in humans. Mm-hmm. A few things we know about rapamycin. We know, first of all, we know that it is a pro-longevity drug in mice, although we have a few caveats there. And it seems to have also positive impacts in more complex organisms like other primates. Mm-hmm. In humans, we don't have great data that it's actually very effective in any kind of long-term health outcome. But that's mostly because of lack of data, because mm-hmm. we haven't done the trials in a proper way. Because rapamycin is used in a daily dose, which is kind of a high dose in people who require immunosuppression, people mm. who have like kidney or liver transplants. To suppress their immunity, we give them rapamycin with other drugs, and that suppresses their immune system. But the idea is that giving it in a less frequent dose, mm. like once weekly, for example, it seems to be a common regime, might have kind of prolonged longevity effects. And we have some data now to show that up to 6 milligrams once a week seems to be safe. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, I'm not promoting this. You need to consult with your physician if this is appropriate for you. But there seems to be some data to show that mm-hmm. frequency is safe. Now, and we can also measure, you know, your immune markers. We can mm-hmm. do some measurements to make sure that we're not impacting your kidneys or liver mm-hmm. Negatively. So that's the safety aspect, but the more tricky part and the difficult part is the effectiveness. Mm-hmm. Are we actually doing anything that is effective? How to measure effectiveness of rapamycin is a bit tricky and a mm-hmm. bit difficult, because there isn't one biomarker, and also you're kind of hoping that on the long term it will slow your progression towards age-related diseases, but you don't have a control. You can't really know that. You can't measure it, and there's no interest in doing large randomized controlled trials for rapamycin, because it's an off-label drug. Mm-hmm. No one makes that much money off it, or it's an off-patent drug. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's talk about measurements then. What are some of the key things people should measure, in your opinion, when they're looking at longevity? So if a person listening to this podcast wants to go out there and order a few tests, what would be some of the basic ones and why?
Well, I like to focus on what I call functional measurements. Mm-hmm. And what are functional measurements? They are measurements that give you the direct function of the organ that you want to measure, that you care about. So a good example here, for example, is VO2 max. Mm-hmm. VO2 max is a measure of your cardiorespiratory fitness. And VO2 max correlates, you know, strongly with longevity. Mm-hmm. Now, VO2 max, there's three components there. There's your heart, there's your respiratory, which is your lungs, and then there's the quality of your muscle and your mitochondrial mm-hmm. Health. So it's really hard to have a really high VO2 max and not be healthy, right? So mm-hmm. whereas, you know, some other biological age markers that are promoted as biological age markers might just reflect like a certain biomarker profile, but not actually correlate to any outcome that you mm-hmm. really care about. So I look at functional biomarkers. One of them is VO2 max. Another would be things like heart function, your we can quantify kind of the function of different organs. One of the lesser or the more difficult ones is the brain and cognitive function. The problem with measuring cognitive function is that it's difficult to measure very early signs of cognitive dysfunction. It's kind of, you know, as soon as it becomes apparent, it's kind of a bit too late, and there's not much you can do about dementia or like early cognitive decline. But we are working on a kind of an AI approach to looking at people's MRI scans of their brains and then quantifying the, and predicting the biological age of their brains based on a large data set of MRIs. So, for example, if you look at thousands of MRI scans of brains with of healthy people, and then you can compare your own MRI, your own brain scan to that data set, and it can kind of give you a prediction: is your brain age higher or lower than your biological age or your chronological age? And that's a biomarker that I'm interested in, that might be useful and might be you might be able to see kind of, you know, change after an intervention over time. But yeah, in general, biological age markers for me are markers that, first of all, correlate with chronological age in a general population. So go down or go up or change with age. So there needs to be an aging component there. Second of all, they need to be correlated to age-related disease outcomes. So, for example, blood pressure is correlated to heart disease, and heart disease is an age-related disease. And the third criteria that is very important is we need evidence that improving that biomarker actually improves your risk of disease down the line. So improving, lowering your blood pressure to a healthy level if you have elevated blood pressure improves your risk of heart disease and lowers it, which is what you care about. Whereas like epigenetic age clocks, for example, while they might be useful in the future, right now we don't have any good evidence to show that improving these biomarkers actually leads to anything that you care about. Like, does improving my biological age, my like pace of aging clock, for example, does that actually, you know, lower my risk of disease in the future? No one knows.
And sometimes you have like false positives, because I've heard a lot of people who are uploading their results on this website, which Brian Johnson helped found. It's called the Pace of Aging. I don't remember the website, but like these guys are seeing how fast they're aging. And sometimes some of them who don't do any kind of biohacking or just living normal lives, their pace of aging is much lower than some of the guys who are spending like millions of dollars.
Yeah, and you can explain that by saying like a big driver of health and longevity is genetics, and that's true. But there's another explanation, is that it's just not accurate. And how to measure that is, if you measure the same person's biological age or pace of aging as well, the same person can have like significant variation within a short time span. Even within the same day, you can see variations of biological age clocks, which gives you an indication that a lot of it is the kind of change in your body environment when it comes to inflammation, hormones, etc. These things influence biological age clocks quite significantly. So, you know, in my take is that it's a nice to have if you want to spend the money, and the way to think about it is, after you've done the kind of more important biomarkers, then you can add on biological age clocks, doing multiple and seeing an improvement over time in multiple biological age markers might give you an indication that at least you're, you know, trending in the right direction.
When you speak about VO2 max, and apart from VO2 max, like your heart health and looking at different organs, can all of this be measured by a blood test, or you need to go into a lab with sophisticated equipment like a calcium score, or like are we advancing to a point where we can just book someone a home test and then we can look at all of these organ markers?
We look at combinations of blood work and functional tests like VO2 max and other kind of fitness markers, along with a like some kind of scan. Mm-hmm. So that can be as detailed as an MRI scan of your whole body, as you said, a calcium score scan, other types of scans, or kind of more simpler things like a DEXA scan to look at kind of body compartments, visceral fat, subcutaneous fat, and then you kind of put that all together to kind of understand the overall picture of the person's health. There isn't one biomarker that encompasses like biological age.
You know, all of this leads to like personalized healthcare and personalized interventions when most of the people over the internet are talking about blanket terms like one size fits all. And for me as well, like from a very early age, I grew up obese and I tried to do a lot of these different things that other people did. It did not work out for me. So I had to figure out what is really working out for me. You got into the personalized healthcare, personalized interventions, coaching at a very early, like earlier, like let's say than most of the people. What drove you into like personalized stuff? Did you see that there is a future? Like, do you have that vision that in the future, everyone would like to see their own sort of results, and rather than listening to blanket terminologies, look at what their body is doing?
Yeah, I'm a big believer of what works on average doesn't necessarily work for every person. Mm-hmm. Even the same intervention. So if you, sometimes you look at studies where they study an intervention on a group of people and then they conclude that it doesn't work because on average it didn't really help. But if you look at it, kind of if you stratify the data, you can see that it actually helped some people, but we don't know what the difference is between, you know, the people it helped and the people it didn't help. But if you were in that group of people the intervention helped, you probably want that intervention because, you know, it might not work on average, but it can work for you. So that's why I think designing kind of N of one experiments that are safe is something that healthcare kind of lacks due to kind of constraint of resources mostly. I'm a big believer of that, but I'm also a believer that, or what I've seen is that there's so much data out there, and if you're not specialized in this stuff, it can be very overwhelming, to the point where you know, people actually it can kind of have an adverse effect on people's health and well-being. So the way we try to frame it is that, look, just outsource all the data that you care about to, you know, us or someone who can help you interpret the data, and then all you need to know is there any ticking time bombs, anything that I need to address right now? Is there any kind of insights that I can help me understand my body? And then are there any actionable steps that I can take to improve those biomarkers?
So you guys have seen a lot of data, like with one of your earlier companies, you were extracting all of this variable data, as you mentioned. What were some of the, you know, we all see that less sleep equals less performance and exercise. So most people know all of these things. Were there some like weird or shocking things that you saw which you did not expect or your team did not expect?
Yeah, there's loads of interesting kind of small variations and small experiments that we used to kind of recommend with people. Most of them were kind of organizing your life around kind of the natural circadian variation of the day. And it was so impressive and so amazing how doing simple things like making sure that you eat most of your food during the day instead of at night, things like movement in the early time, the early hours of the day, and getting sunlight, getting exposure to sun, and then doing the reverse at night, how it just improves all of your biomarkers, your sleep score, your, you know, deep sleep, REM sleep, HRV improves, your resting heart rate goes down. You know, that was kind of, that really showed me the impact of kind of living kind of within that natural circadian, within your natural circadian rhythm, and taking that into consideration. Another one that is interesting is the impact of temperature on sleep. So I saw this really interesting study about pre-industrial societies that don't have indoor heating or electric lighting. And the they looked at like how these societies sleep. They usually sleep. You would think that they sleep when the sun goes down, right? But it actually is not the case. They usually go to sleep 3 hours after the sun goes down, and it's usually mm-hmm. when the temperature starts dropping. Mm-hmm. So temperature is a bigger kind of cue for your internal biology your temperature drops tells your internal biology that you need to go to sleep, mm-hmm. and you need to drop your body temperature in mm-hmm. order to go to sleep and get enough deep sleep and REM sleep. So that was an interesting point. And once we started kind of coaching people to think of their internal indoor heating mm-hmm. in that way, like cooling off at night and in their sleep environment, mm-hmm. that has a huge impact on sleep mm-hmm. markers.
Interesting. Maybe that's also the same reason why eating earlier, 3 to 4 hours before, and when yeah. your food is already digested, your sleep, your core body temperature will decrease.
Exactly.
Having things like glycine, which is an amino acid, which also reduces the body temperature, helps you fall asleep faster. Your sleep latency is higher.
100%.
And sleeping in a cooler room. And it happens to me every time I travel, right? I'm one of those people that I say, hey, listen, even if I'm going to a cold place, make sure there's no heater, because at least in the night, there are two things that I want to make sure of. One is that there's not a lot of light that's coming into the room. And, here in UAE, we're kind of lucky because most of the places, there are these big curtains that are completely blackout. But Europe and so many other places, hotels don't have that. So that's one of my criteria. I'm looking for a complete blackout curtain. And there have been points where, I've taken garbage bags and stuck them on the windows yeah. because, light is such a big, light and temperature, both of them are such big cues. And then food as well.
Yeah, 100%.
Also, interestingly, it's when your core body temperature decreases and your, melatonin is also increasing at the same time. So you fall asleep. And as you're about to wake up, your core body temperature increases, right? And that also signals your body and the environment as well, because the sun is about to rise.
Yeah.
It's so beautifully tied in that, if you just look at how we were supposed to be in nature, and of course, better living with science is always encouraged. But when you go back to the basics, everything's there.
Yeah.
Most of the things are there.
100%. Another thing that I also learned is that you can only do so much with bio-wearable data mm-hmm. as they are currently. And that's why right now we only focus on blood biomarkers mm-hmm. and lab-based tests, because those are still really way more informative when it comes to long-term health mm-hmm. than your kind of day-to-day bio-wearable data.
What about, are you looking at hormonal profiles like testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, and that's also a part of the blood biomarker?
100%. I mean, hormones are such a important and integral part of aging. So that's not an area of kind of specialty of mine as a mm-hmm. physician, but it is definitely something that is mm-hmm. That we test and take into account.
What are your thoughts on something which is right now the craze, GLP-1 agonist Ozempic? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, of course. It's such a powerful breakthrough
mm-hmm.
that I think they're fantastic mm-hmm. Drugs for many people. Now, they might be abused in certain cases, but overall, I think obesity is such a problem worldwide, and it's only getting worse, that any kind of extra tool that we can have in the mm-hmm. toolbox is way very much welcome. And people kind of contrast GLPs with diet and exercise, that they're why don't we work on improving the environment? Why don't we, consume less processed foods and sugar, mm-hmm. etc. But I mean, I think we can do all of that. It's not an either or,
yeah.
You can use GLPs for those who need them, and you can also, work on improving our overall mm-hmm. environment.
Yeah, it's interesting, especially because certain parts of the world where obesity is much more than the other places. And, you know, they've been trying to fight this for years and there is no solution. Those guys are the same people who go to the gym, who do their dieting, and they're doing a little bit of like everything. But because of, you know, various, it could be genetic, it could be stress related, hormone related, there are so many, toxin related, there are so many of these markers that even when someone's trying really hard can pull them back.
I mean, I think people underestimate the genetic element in obesity because obesity is a modern phenomenon. And they're like, you know, how can a genetic disease or genetic phenomenon be so modern if it's genetic? Therefore, it must be environmental. But you can't really look at environment without looking at genetics. So basically, if you have a predisposition to obesity or a predisposition to kind of seeking out high-calorie, dense foods, that it's probably a pro-survival thing in the past because of lack of, in a scarce environment, this same genetic element can lead to obesity in a, you know, in a post-scarcity society that we live in. It's kind of similar to the antagonistic pleiotropy concept model that we talked about earlier, which is, you know, something that the same mechanism that can be useful at some point in development, later in development can actually be
backfire.
It can backfire and be detrimental to us.
Yeah, also like genetic propensity in the brain, where, you know, some people have this propensity of looking for novel experiences, or, you know, their dopamine pools being exhausted really fast, the DDR2 receptors. Those kind of changes, those kind of variations in an individual will also create, like, you know, addictive sort of personalities where people stick to one food and then they can't get rid of it. So I see at least in the people that I know and I talk to, there are certain people who just naturally get addicted to different things. And if food comes in or alcohol comes in or like parties come in, they just go all in on that. And then, you know, it's difficult to get them out of it unless and until you replace that addiction with something else.
Some interesting data on GLPs, for example, show that it show improvements in other sides of in other habits that can be addictive as well, like smoking, even things like you know, addiction to gambling, etc. There might be an angle there where GLP-1 agonists, and there's more complex GLP-1 agonists now that are like dual receptor agonists or even triple receptor. They work on different pathways, and these are going to be really powerful drugs to not just counter obesity, in my opinion, like things like alcoholism, maybe smoking even. There might be long-term health benefits that are not even related to improvement of obesity. So there might be improvement in cognitive dysfunction markers, heart health, that are independent than improving your weight. I think they're very interesting drugs, and yeah, we're going to see, there's, I think, tens of even more than that drugs in this space that are in development that will be available over the upcoming years.
Interesting. Are you excited for something that you know about that's being under the research or something? What would be the next Ozempic, like, according to you?
I guess there are certain biomarkers of aging that are kind of increase your risk of disease that are difficult to move and difficult to improve. But there are like drugs that are addressing these problems. So a good example is one of the biomarkers that people under measure, and especially in traditional medicine, is LPA, LP little A. And LPA is a, well, it's basically a measure of atherogenic particles, particles that kind of accumulate in your arteries and ultimately lead to atherosclerosis, hardening of your arteries, and ultimately heart disease and heart attacks. And up to recently, we didn't know how important this marker was and how, you know, closely it correlates with heart disease. And it's an independent risk factor, or kind of a special risk factor in this category. And it's usually driven genetically. So if certain individuals have a genetic predisposition to a high LPA level, which leads them to have a high risk of heart disease, targeting LPA with lifestyle interventions doesn't work because it's genetic. So these people need to live with it, basically. But there are certain drugs that might improve LPA slightly like PCSK9 inhibitors. That's an interesting study on aspirin that can possibly, like a low dose of aspirin can
like
possibly,
a mini aspirin or a low
dose, a baby aspirin can improve risk of heart disease with people who have LPA, an elevated LPA. And there are drugs in the pipeline that are going to be able to kind of lower LPA significantly. So those, you know, those are the types of drugs that I'm interested in.
I have never seen, I've seen so many people's blood reports here in Dubai. I've never seen anyone's report with LPAA. And like sometimes, like I've had a few friends and clients and I've asked them like, hey, can you please look for this marker? And then the cost of just adding this one marker in this part of the world is like almost the same as adding the all the other markers.
Yeah, and I mean, there's an argument to say that I kind of there's a cost argument here. You usually you can't get this this test done on insurance, etc., is because we don't have targeted interventions towards it. So, you know, if it's elevated, there's not much you can do about it. I don't agree with that because even if there's nothing you can do about LPA, now, and we know there is, you know, with off-label medications, like PCSK9 inhibitors, you know, that are that can be used for this purpose, possibly. But even if there isn't, you want to know that it's, if you know that it's elevated, you can be even more strict on other risk factors that are related to heart disease in order to kind of lower your cumulative risk profile.
I've heard of a stack, vitamin D, baby aspirin, and magnesium. Take all of these things together and it helps quite a lot. The other thing, what you're saying is, it would be interesting for a certain subset of the population to know because, you know, there are like, it's still happening, but like 2 or 3 years ago, the ketogenic diet was such a big thing, right? Almost everyone that I know about was trying ketogenic diet. Most of them were trying to, you know, having a big block of butter. So like going dirty keto. And like, if you already have risk factors driving from your genetics for like cholesterol mechanisms or like LPAA or APOE, then you're kind of, if you don't know much about it, then it's going to, you know, do more damage in the long term.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, look, cholesterol markers are not the only risk factors for heart disease. There's like loads of risk factors, and they're possibly not even the most important, but they are a modifiable risk factor that we can actually address. And we know that elevated LDL, ApoB, LPA is definitely correlated and causative of heart disease. But there are other things like insulin resistance, high
hyperglycemia,
which is increasing your blood sugar levels, high insulin levels. These are also strong risk factors for heart disease.
Can these be modified easily? Like, the way I look at it is like, okay, we know a certain subset of problem exists. Like, now, what are some of the natural ways we can go about it? Of course, there's, you know, all of these different pharmaceutical approaches, maybe peptides. But like, what do you think? Like, we spoke about like doing the basics for someone who has these kind of risk profiles. Is there something that they can do naturally which will help, like lifestyle or?
I mean, we usually do things in three kind of categories: is lifestyle, supplements, and prescription medications. Now, lifestyle is always the kind of baseline to start with, but then you stack on top of that supplements. You can stack on top of that prescription medications if appropriate, and then you have kind of many tools that can address these problems. Obviously, it depends on the biomarker that you want to improve, but lifestyle is usually kind of pretty similar for all biomarkers, and then when you go up the pyramid of lifestyle supplements and medications, the higher up, the more specific you get. So, for example, if you have elevated risk of heart disease because of high ApoB, for example, your lifestyle recommendations are probably going to be, you know, certain types of exercise, certain types of you know, nutritional interventions. But these are going to be similar to someone who has elevated blood sugar, for example.
You're probably pretty generalized.
Although there are kind of specific interventions, for example, like elevated blood pressure can be treated quite successfully with specific types of exercises, like isometric training. Isometric exercises can lower blood pressure. So there is some variation there, but usually it's kind of a bit similar. And then the higher up you go, the more specific the intervention you recommend.
Let's talk about the second part of that pyramid, like supplements. Let's focus on longevity. What are your top supplements for longevity?
In general, supplements are actually not that important for longevity. Mm-hmm. So just to have that caveat in mind, the way I think about interventions in general is you look at it through cost and effectiveness. So for example, exercise is a, I would say, a high cost intervention because it takes a lot of your time, an hour a day, etc. But it's a very effective intervention. So that's why it's worth doing. Some supplements, or most supplements, fall into the category of, you know, sometimes high cost, sometimes moderate cost or low cost, but kind of low level of effectiveness.
Efficacy, yeah.
So it's just important to have that kind of frame of mind when you think about supplements. There are supplements that can be useful. So, you know, a very common supplement that we recommend is creatine monohydrate, a very safe supplement. Although, anecdotally, I have seen people have worse kidney markers on creatine
levels.
Now there's some nuance here. I had this big debate on Twitter with some doctors who attacked me because I said that. Because when you look at the research, there's a correlation between ingestion of creatine monohydrate and an increase in creatinine, which is a product that is filtered through your kidneys, and that's naturally increased when you increase your absorption of creatine, because it's a metabolite of creatine. But that doesn't actually mean that it's impacting your kidneys negatively. But we measure a different, we use a different measure that is not correlated to creatine, which is called cystatine C, which is a measure of kidney health. And usually, you don't see a correlation between the two. I've anecdotally seen it in one or two cases. So that's why I always kind of caution just to get that measurement done if you're taking creatine regularly, just for the sake of mind. And it's probably my own bias, you know, seeing these cases. But in general, it's a pretty safe supplement. And what it does is creatine is basically acts as kind of this energy reserve that your muscles can access quickly. And it can help. So it can help kind of your improving muscle mass, metabolism, and there's some evidence to show that creatine can improve cognitive health as well. That's one. Another one is omega-3 fish oil. Now, this one is a bit tricky because it's not just, you know, take omega-3 for everyone. It depends on your biomarker that we measure is omega-3 index and omega-6-3 ratio. You want to get your omega-6 and to versus omega-3 ratio down as low as possible. Modern diets are usually high in but less than three is ideally where it should be. Usually, it's difficult to do that without supplementation. If you eat a lot of oily fish, you can do it. You know, salmon, for example. Excuse me. So omega-3 is something that we measure, and then we recommend a certain dosage based on your biomarkers. And there's certain forms of omega-3 that can be betterly absorbed into your cells, like the triglyceride form of omega-3 fish oils. Now, and another supplement that I recommend often is, I mean, you can consider protein powders as a supplement. And they could be a good adjunct to people who are not ingesting enough protein to kind of support muscle mass and reduce muscle atrophy. The protein that I usually recommend is whey protein isolate. If you're a vegetarian, a rice pea blend of kind of 30% rice, 70% pea seems to be optimal when it comes to amino acid composition that is quite comparable to whey protein. And then there's a bunch of other supplements. You mentioned magnesium. I think magnesium is definitely a interesting supplement because most people are kind of run low on magnesium, especially people who work out a lot. You can lose a lot of magnesium in your sweat and you don't ingest that much of magnesium through diet. So supplementing with magnesium in the form of magnesium gluconate, glycinate, L-threonate can be a good source of magnesium as well. And then there's a bunch of other things depending on kind of your biomarkers as well.
Cool. Adam, I can keep talking to you, and this could be a multiple, series podcast, but I think we should cut it for today. If you had a time machine and if we could go back in time, this is my last question. If you could go back in time and you could give your younger self one piece of advice, what would that be?
It's always a tough one because, I wouldn't change a thing, but I also would change many things. Mm-hmm. it's always difficult to answer that question. But I guess one piece of advice is that, it'll work out eventually, so don't stress about it too much.
Okay. Yeah. It all falls into place.
It all falls into place. And you can't predict the future.
Amazing. Adam, this has been fun. I'm sure the next time you're in Dubai, I'll catch you again for series 2 of this podcast. Before you go, where can people find you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, so Dr. Adam Bhatt, DRADAMBAT.
Instagram, we'll put all the show. Yeah. Anything that you're working on that you would like people to go check out, any of your new projects?
Well, we're always working on improving our services at Numenor Health, which is my online longevity service based out of the UK. So, that's
great. So everyone check that out. We'll put the link in the show notes. Adam, once again, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Shout out to Hani as well, who connected us. Yep. Appreciate him. And this is me, CJ, your host, signing out of the Shift for CJ podcast. Everyone have a great day, a great week, a great lifetime. And remember, eventually, it all falls into place. See you in the next podcast.
Nice.
Artlist.io.
Your time and presence with us through this podcast is highly appreciated. If you want to learn more, then head over to our website, www.shiftwithcj.com.